The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Live from the WGBB studios in Merrick, New York, this is Sports Talk New York.
From the crossroads of Sunrise Highway and Merrick Avenue in beautiful Merrick, Long Island, New York, this is Long Island's WGBB Sports Talk New York, 95.9 FM, 1240 AM. I'm your host, Mike Guidone, joined as always by the man we call Cappy, Chris Caputo. 516-623-1240 is the number. Again, that's 516-623-1240. Talking everything sports. Got a big show for you tonight. Connor Clark's going to join us, our NCAA football expert. Later on, we'll be joined by A.J. Rovner, our Giants reporter, to talk about, well, if you saw the game, I'm not even going to say anything at the moment. I'll save that for a few minutes. And then have a great story to finish off tonight, Anthony Pecorella, punter from Maine, Long Island kid, who's going to join us and talk about his story, which is very interesting and just stick-to-itiveness. But before we get to any of that, we've been waiting a few weeks. Cappy's sitting here. He's ready to blast off on the Mets. Cap, the floor is yours.
How we doing, Mike?
Oh, we're doing great.
We had a little break. We were here with 1 week left in the regular season.
Yes.
We had John Hansen on. We talked about what would they have to do to kind of close that out, and we all thought it would have to be 5-1 because at that point they had lost the tiebreaker.
Right.
And we said 4-2 was going to be tough because that meant somebody else needed to go 3-3. Well, there we were.
Yep.
Last day of the season, and Mets needed to win, and also we needed help. Got the help.
Didn't get the win.
And it just, Mike, it actually wasn't that upsetting at the time.
Right.
Because I think we had prepared ourselves for it.
Yes. I sit here tonight and I think, you know, it's almost like a meeting. I feel like, hi, my name is Mike. I'm a New York Mets fan. I'm a New York sports fan. And I'm here to just vent. Cap, you're here as well. I mean, there was the famous phrase, you play to win the game.
Yeah.
Casey Stengel once said, can anybody here play the game? Can anybody win a game? Can anybody do anything well here in New York sports? Please. I mean, the hockey season has just started, so I'm not even going to get going with that. But for Pete's sake.
Yeah, just win one. Oh. I mean, think about this, Mike. We talk about this all the time. And it just gets me to the point where I'm sitting there going, why waste my time? Every single freaking year, I get myself juiced up for this stupid team. I'm 48 years old. When am I going to have the chance to watch this team win a championship? One time, not 20, one lousy time. Gee whiz. Every single time. Can you beat the Florida freaking Miami Marlins? One time. 2007, up 17 with 17 to go. 2008, blow it again. The Nationals come in and beat us. 1998, we lose to the Royals in 2015. The Yankees in 2000. The lousy Marlins. I have to watch them on the field celebrate them beating us. Now I watch Ohtani hitting three homers in a game, striking out 10 guys, and I'm out again. I just want one. I mean, Mike, I'll give up talking about it here on Sports Talk New York. No more Mets. No more John Hansen. No more James Schiano of Mets stuff. Just one time. Can we win one time? It's been since 1986.
Yeah. And in 1986, as I'm watching the ball go through Bill Buckner's legs, and we get to a Game 7 and we win, I'm 18 years old. I'm thinking, you know, is this the last time I'm going to see a Mets victory? It's almost like the curse of the Bambino in reverse. We got so lucky during that year when we should have won it.
Yeah, and we probably should have lost that game.
Should have lost that game, should have lost the series. And it's almost like now, no matter what happens, it's just never going to
I just
change.
Knew. You know, you asked me that night, and I said, they're not going to make it. And you asked me that day, and I knew it was going to fall apart. And to not be able to even put up a run. The last game of the season. Now, were they going to go out to Los Angeles and beat the Dodgers? Probably not. There's a lot that needs to change, and we'll talk about that in future shows. But it just hurts every time to go into work and to hear people say, oh, they can't even make the wild card. You guys were winning the division a couple of weeks ago. It just kills me. And we have to take it. You got to just take it.
No, you have to. And no matter what, like you said, even if you squeak that game out, You go to Los Angeles, you play. It's bad news all around. Nothing better was going to happen. You almost felt a sense of relief from the players leaving the dugout that day. It was like, you know what, let's just pack it up and call it a year. So many things that we can talk about and get through that, which we will.
And we will. And yeah. Watching the Dodgers right now, it's amazing. Yeah, you know, to watch guys like Ohtani and Yamamoto and Blake Snell and just random guys coming up clutch for them.
Playing to the best of their ability. These superstars playing to the best of their ability at the right time. I don't think anybody's going to touch them.
Well, there's the rant. And later you'll hear the Giants
rant. The Giants rant, yes.
But there is a lot going on in college football that I think we're going to get to right here.
Absolutely. And listen, anybody out there who might be a yoga specialist, deep breathing, meditation, please feel free to call in. Both Chris and I could use that tonight at some respect. But, yes, as you mentioned, we're going to go right now to our NCAA College Football Insider, Connor Clark, who's going to join us, talk a little bit about the top 25, what it's looking like for the playoff coming up, and also the coaching carousel. We have about 20 names I have right here on my list. Can't wait to hear what Connor thinks. Connor, welcome to the program, buddy. How are you?
Hey, what's going on, Mike and Chris?
We're doing all right. You know, we did a little pre-rant on the Mets because it's been a while since we came on. I know you're a Philly fan. We're not going to talk Giants with you right now, but, you know, enjoy that win for you guys tonight because I know last week was a tough one. But let's talk college football. So we're looking at the top 25. I really have in front of me right now the top 12. I know you're a big Ohio State fan, supporter. How many of these top teams have a legit chance, do you feel, right now? You know, coming in on the end of October, still early, how many of these teams do you feel have a legit chance to win the national championship?
Yeah, looking at the top 12 right now, you know, I would say there's probably six or seven. Obviously, you have Ohio State, Indiana, and Alabama kind of their 1, 2, and 4. I actually think Texas A&M could pull it off. Mm-hmm. Right now, they're going through some oddities with regards to their defense on the road versus at home. On the road, they're giving up about a little bit over 40 points a game.
Wow.
But at home, they're stout. Obviously, Georgia is still there, and they can pull it off. Oregon looked amazing against Rutgers. They had a one-off against Indiana. And then Ole Miss, Miami, and Notre Dame. I would put those three in as well. So I think the race is still wide open as of right now. And you know, it really is anyone's game this deep into October.
How about the Vanderbilt Commodores? Top 10 for the first time since 1947. I mean, did they even have real helmets back in 1947?
Yeah, I know, right?
What a great story.
No, Vanderbilt is a fantastic, they're a fantastic team. They play a very college-oriented style of offense, led by Diego Pavia, of course, from New Mexico State a few years ago. You know, they're a team that's going to put up, you know, 35-plus every game. It's just a matter of can the defense hold on. Now, they almost beat Alabama on the road a few weeks ago. They got some turnover issues in that game, and so, unfortunately, it didn't go their way. But Vanderbilt, if the defense can hold up against better competition, yes, I can see them also potentially winning the title as well.
That would be absolutely unbelievable.
Connor, the Big Ten is really the Big 18 now. There's 18 teams in the Big Ten, you know, which obviously you get to a point where a lot of teams are not even going to play each other in a regular season, let alone will they match up in the Big Ten championship. How do you kind of – every week a big team has to play a big team. So how do you look at them and say, you know, this team's in the playoffs, possibly out of the playoffs, when you have big shots playing each other every week? So you got a team, Northwestern, 3-1. If they lose a game, are they now dropping deep because they played somebody like Iowa or Michigan? You know, it's just very hard with 18 teams there, don't you think?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that's one of the things that – you know, with regards to these massive conferences, they didn't really think of. For the Big Ten, I know that the plan was if an athlete was to stay for all 4 years, they would get a chance to play on the road at every single Big Ten stadium. That was sort of their mindset coming into it. But right now they're at 18. Who knows if they balloon bigger? But from your point, Chris, you know, it is really hard. You kind of have to look at a number of things. One of the things early on in seasons that, you know, a lot of bettors look at and a lot of other people who are focused more on sort of determining who might be good and who isn't good is recruiting rankings. And so when it comes to a team like an Ohio State, like an Alabama, like a Georgia, well, they recruit at a very high level, so that's why they're up at the top. If you talk about, you know, other teams, for instance, like a USC who's very talented, unfortunately, in certain cases, it might be coaching, where a few years ago they had terrible coaching on the defensive side of the ball, and so even though they had all that talent, they were still a 7-5 team. So when it comes down to kind of looking at, okay, if Northwestern, say, loses to a Wisconsin instead of, let's say, an Ohio State, it's probably best to look at things like, you know, margin of victory as well as sort of the quality of player, 1 through 85, that a team like Wisconsin has as opposed to a team like Ohio State. So that's one way to look at it, but, you know, you're totally right. And then the other X factor is the transfer portal, because a great example is Florida State. Florida State beat Alabama by a wide margin in the first game of the year, but since then they've dropped four straight. So, you know, when it comes to can a coach rally the troops if they're all made of transfers and things like that, that's another X factor that comes into play. So, you know, it's harder than ever to determine who's good and who's not. But, you know, I think we're doing the best we can right now. Hopefully within the next month and a half or so, things begin to tighten up a little bit. But there is a real possibility, you know, that we could see, for instance, if Ohio State wins up until the Michigan game and they lose against Michigan, then all of a sudden this 11-1 team is now fourth in the Big Ten rankings. It's just crazy with these 18 teams in there.
Connor Clark joins us here on the program, our college football insider. So, Connor, we're taking a look. Top 25, there's Indiana Hoosiers at number two. Normally, if you said the Indiana Hoosiers is number two, you're thinking college basketball. But here they are in football right now. What has Kirk Cignetti done to turn that program around? And you know, going up against a team like Ohio State, which is obviously, you know, 60 votes to six here for the number one, you know, not exactly, you know, took it by a full vote, but, you know, pretty close. But what's Indiana done over these last few years to be able to get to this number two, where they were really just basically an afterthought in college football?
Yeah, so, you know, Indiana, like you said, their history has not been great with regards to football. Obviously, basketball is a little bit different. But, you know, the first thing that happened when Kirk Cignetti was signed by Indiana was that a lot of players from his James Madison team actually came in and, you know, created this nucleus that they could build around. So, like, for instance, Aiden Fisher, the linebacker, D'Angelo Pons, another one, he's a cornerback. So these guys that were fantastic for James Madison and led to them being a dominant Group of Five team were being dropped into Big Ten play. Now, the other aspect of Indiana, which they're doing at a better clip than anyone else, is they are fantastic at identifying talent in the transfer portal. And there's no other position where they are, you know, best other than quarterback. And so when you look at it, they had Curtis Rourke a year ago. Here's a guy from Ohio University, okay, and he comes in and he is lighting up the Big Ten. Now we're looking at Fernando Mendoza from Cal, who's coming in, and people are talking about him as, you know, the number one overall pick. They're doing a phenomenal job when it comes to, you know, identifying the talent in the transfer portal and maybe looking at guys that might otherwise go overlooked in those positions. And now they're starting to get guys on the lines of scrimmage. That was where they were outmanned last year when they played Notre Dame, when they played Ohio State. The number one point of emphasis was sort of that gap in the line of scrimmage play. And so this year they brought in a transfer from Notre Dame on the offensive side. He's looking good. And they're bringing in more transfers on the defensive side of the ball. And they have really beefed up there. And that's how they won against Oregon. You know, they were just kind of pushing Oregon around. And not many teams have been able to do that since Dan Lanning's been in Eugene. So it's been quite the turnaround. It's definitely here to stay for this year. It's going to be interesting to see if he's able to, personally, that is, able to do this again for the years to come. But he just signed an 8-year, $93 million contract because of the James Franklin news. So he's there to stay. So we'll see how things continue to progress for him.
Connor, anybody outside of the big conferences or maybe even, you know, a smaller team that we're not used to hearing of have a chance of sneaking in or, you know, might be a sleeper that has a chance for the national championship in your mind?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a couple of teams. You know, there's a team way at the bottom of the AP poll at number 25 in Michigan who, if you got a chance to watch them against Washington, you know, Bryce Underwood, their five-star true freshman quarterback, is looking the part. And, you know, their star running back, Justice Haynes, was out with what I believe was something to do with his abdomen. And, you know, Jordan Marshall, a true sophomore four-star, came in and looked dominant against that Washington defense. So, and they have a freshman receiver as well named Andrew Marsh, who is really coming on as of late. Two past games, he looked phenomenal. So if they can continue to put it all together, and if they can kind of get healthy on the offensive and defensive line, I think they would definitely be a tough out for anyone in the playoff. And they're certainly not out of it right now. Along with that, with regards to the Group of Five spot, you know, one team in particular that they're in the receiving votes category for right now, but San Diego State, you know, Sean Lewis was hired away from Kent State to be the offensive coordinator for Colorado under Deion Sanders. Deion Sanders decided to make a change, and Sean Lewis left, and he has done a phenomenal job. So that is another one that has the potential to, you know, make some noise in the playoffs for sure if they can get in.
All right, so, Connor, I'm going to throw some names at you here. Billy Napier, Florida. James Franklin, Penn State. Mike Gundy, Oklahoma State. Deshaun Foster, UCLA. Sam Pittman, Arkansas. Brent Pry, Virginia Tech. It's not even Halloween and trick-or-treat time for these guys. They're all out. So let's talk about, well, first of all, here, James Franklin of Penn State. I mean, the man got the bag to not coach anymore.
Thank you.
Yeah, what are you talking, 50 mil? And he's got to prove that he's
life
at least,
insurance policy.
Yeah, he's got to at least prove that he's looking for a job. I wouldn't mind that. Heck, I'd take $5 million for that. But, yeah, seriously, all right, so he's out, all these guys. But the candidate list is long. I'm curious to see. Let's start with Penn State. Who truly, in your eyes, who do you think is really on their radar? Or do you think it's already pretty much been decided that they know who they're going to because they fired Franklin at this point?
I think...
you think Matt Rhule?
You know, I think right now there was a report, I forget who came out with it, but there was a report that they were going to take a swing at Marcus Freeman at Notre Dame. I think that they are trying to make a big swing because they believe that they are one of the top, you know, two or three programs in the country and they should have a top two or three head coach. I think that because of how much they have to pay James Franklin, I know it's not a lump sum, but they do have to pay that over a number of years. That's still millions of dollars that are going towards him. I wonder, you know, if they are going to have to settle with someone else. You know, Nittany Lions Wire came out with a list. A few names of theirs that are on this list that I like are Manny Diaz, who's the Duke coach, who is the defensive coordinator at Penn State, Fran Brown, who's the Syracuse head coach, who knows the area well. And if they were going to take a big swing at anyone, I think it would be a Mike Elko at Texas A&M, who's from the area. He grew up in New Jersey. He went to Penn. So, you know, these are guys that are familiar with the area. They can all recruit, and, you know, they all have shown that they can be quality coaches. When it comes to Matt Rhule has not beaten a ranked opponent in I don't even know when. Yeah. I mean, he has done it at Nebraska, and he hasn't done it at Baylor. And those are his last two stops in college. So, you know, you think about that along with the fact that he doesn't seem to be the best recruiter. He seems to be a better developer. I'm not sure he fits the mold of sort of what Penn State wants in a coach. I know that he, you know, went there as a walk-on under Joe Paterno and, you know, loves Penn State, was the Temple head coach and everything like that. But, you know, I just don't necessarily see that fit. I know that another name they're looking at is Kenny Dillingham from Arizona State, but he's an Arizona State alum. I have a hard time seeing him leave. The other name that I think they should take a swing at is Eli Drinkwitz at Missouri. I think that Eli can recruit. I think that he's maximized what Missouri can do. And I think that he could come in and elevate Penn State to that, you know, perennial national title contending program.
All right, last question before we let you go, Connor. Is Lane Kiffin the next head coach at the University of Florida?
Short answer, no.
Oh, okay.
I think it's going to be Jed Fish, okay. The Washington head coach. I think they're really worried about having a quarterback because DJ Wagley loved, you know, Billy Napier. And Jed Fish is an alum of Florida. He's proven to be a fantastic coach. And he is DeMond Williams, who looks like the next Lamar Jackson, Kyler Murray kind of sensation. He has him attached to him at his hip. So, you know, if you get Jed Fish, there's a good chance you get DeMond Williams, too. So I think it's going to be him.
Well, Connor, great stuff as always. Look forward to having you on in a couple weeks as we get closer towards the playoffs. And also, congratulations to you. This is your first time on with us as a married man. Full disclosure, Connor is married to my niece, Allie, but he is a fantastic college football guy, but even a better person. Connor, thanks so much, buddy, and all the best, and we'll talk to you soon.
Well, thank you very much, Mike. Okay. Take care, guys.
All right, you got
Good job.
Connor Clark, as always, absolute encyclopedic knowledge of
every coach,
college.
Assistant coach.
He knows it all. I'm telling you.
Transferred. Amazing.
He's got it. He definitely has. And full disclosure again, I don't really talk to him about what teams I'm going to bring up. And he's got
there.
It. It's not like we haven't rehearsed this, folks. All right.
Time to rant.
Yeah, time to rant. So let's go out of the college game and let's go to the circus that was the New York Giant game today. And we're going to bring in our Giant insider, A.J. Rovner. A.J., how you doing, buddy? Have you recovered from that circus that was happening today?
Oh, yeah, it was certainly an interesting one, and a game where
it
was an occurrence that hadn't happened in over 1,500 games.
Ah, yeah.
We can get into that in a little bit. I just want to first off say thanks to Chris for giving me the opportunity to also PA announce at the high school. That was on my agenda to first off thank him for that, but now we can get into some what I just watched for the last 3.5 hours.
I mean, 33 points in one quarter.
Franchise record for Denver.
Two missed extra points. It's your turn to rant. We've already tried to get some out.
Yeah, I mean, it was, I read a stat here, 1,602 consecutive games when leading by 18-plus points with 6 minutes or less to play in the fourth quarter until the Giants lost to Denver today. I mean, listen, you know, Jude Nafatemi is a kicker from the International Exchange Program, which doesn't count as a roster hit. So that's like the part that really is appealing to a coach. But this was a guy who was the backup kicker at Rutgers. He wasn't even the starting guy. And, you know, it's a huge role to have. And we signed Younghoe Koo after Gano went down, and they still gave Nafatemi a chance, and he missed an extra point last week against the Eagles, which ultimately didn't play a factor in the contest. But tonight, obviously, it did. He missed two, and it forced Staber to try and get that point back early in the game with a touchdown. And, you know, a couple of other things, Paulson Adebo, the corner we got from New Orleans in the offseason, him getting hurt and replaced by Deontay Banks really hurt the Giants. They were pitching a shutout with Adebo in the game. Javon Holland as well, our safety that we also got in the offseason, got hurt as well. And it's just, you know, Dart made a really bad read as well on that interception. But it is what it is. You know, I always try and take the positive out that this was the best defense on paper in football and on every metric. And we had a rookie quarterback going to a tough environment and the most difficult environment to play in, not only the crowd loud, but the high altitude, and just makes such a difference when you're playing such a contact outdoor sport like football, and to have four touchdowns at almost 300 yards. It's certainly promising, but very upsetting loss. So I'll let you guys ask whenever you want to ask.
Yeah, to me, you know, I was in the car on my way here listening to them down by by 4 points. They needed to score a touchdown, and the crazy penalty puts them close. And, you know, I heard him kind of dive, and they're saying that he made it and he should have made it. And in my mind, I felt like they scored too quick, because even if they kicked the extra point, now the other team has a chance. You know, if I was them, I would have tried to dive towards the half-yard line, maybe let it run down, and then, you know, you still have your timeout if you don't get it on second down. But either way, you know, I mean, this is just tough. I know we've talked in the past, and it's coulda, woulda, shoulda, but, like, the Dallas game and this game has implications on this team being, you know, competitive in the NFC East.
100%, and Dallas loses today. Beat Washington. There are three wins. Philly has four. Right now you have the tiebreaker. No, Philly has five. Sorry, 5-2. But if the Giants win this game, there's no secret. They're right in this thing.
Yeah, they're in the place.
They're 3-4, and you go to Philly, a team you just dismantled. They don't really impress me as much as in years past. Saquon Barkley's taken a tremendous step back. It seems like every year that powerful Eagles offensive line, either a guy's retiring and Kelsey or someone's getting hurt like Mailata or Lane Johnson. And I really had faith, and there was just so much optimism. And listen, you know, it's just so demoralizing to know you're right there, just like in the Dallas game and today. But if Jackson Dart starts those first three games, I would have to assume the Giants probably have another win or two.
Yes.
But today, what I think was his first critical mistake, and not knowing the clock. You know, instead of forcing that ball, just go down, take a snap. That's an extra 40 seconds left they have. You know, the play that he made, the really bad read on the pick. But he made some bad throws down the stretch, too. But overall, I thought he was excellent.
Yeah, you can't blame him for what happened there. And it really, as you mentioned, stepping into that atmosphere against that defense, which is tremendous, you can't blame him. And coming back to get them into a position, really, which they should have won the game. You mentioned the Dallas game and also, you know, tonight. So fourth quarter, it seems the defense, and again, I know in Denver with the altitude, it's a little different thing that we're talking about here. But fourth quarter, the defense is just gassed.
Right. And I certainly think that plays a factor. But also, Paulson Adebo and just bringing Deontay Banks, it's just such a significant downgrade. And if you just look at all the metrics, it's such a difference in production. And Cordell Flott is the Giants' second quarterback now, and alongside Adebo, and Adebo was locking off Cortland Sutton, who's one of the best Bronco receivers of all time, in my opinion, and Frost on Troy Franklin. And now that Adebo's down, Flott has to go over to Sutton, and Banks has to come into guard of Franklin, and it just made such a difference down the stretch having him. And you know they're going to be throwing the ball a lot because they're playing from behind all game, Denver. And it does make a difference when one guy comes out and another guy comes in. But the altitude, of course, plays a factor. There's no doubt about it. But my dad, I was talking about, this is the best place to kick. This is like a kicker's dream.
Yeah. You know, I could drill one from 30
there. Think about Brandon, Aubrey going from Dallas to be able to kick in Denver. This guy could probably kick the ball to 70 yards. So it's really unfortunate. And the Giants have just never been able to figure out the kicking situation with this regime. Graham Gano has been hurt now. We gave him such a huge contract. And last year we had Jamie Gillen kick because we couldn't activate a kicker
horrendous
in time. But just there's always some sort of issue with the kicking. And I mean, Young Wei Pu is just sitting in his apartment building right now, and he's rubbing for New Jersey. He couldn't have done any less, man. Couldn't have done any worse.
Well, AJ, let's try to finish on a positive note. Can you talk about some of the progression that Jackson Dart has had since they put him into the starting role and what he's meant to this Giants team and the fans?
I think first off, you have to think of the word fun. And so many fans have just been waiting to have fun again and cheer in the crowd. And we had a little bit of glimpse with that with Tommy Cutlet, but we all knew that that would die down and not be the same. And this is a guy that the Giants traded up for, had a lot of aspirations, And he's lived up to it. I don't think there's any secret about it that Jackson Dart has been phenomenal in these first four games, and him and Scataboo, and just it really is fun to watch the offense and see a quarterback maneuver in the pocket. I've never seen that. Listen, I had the pleasure of watching Eli Manning in my old childhood, but he couldn't move in the pocket like that. Daniel Jones is starting to move like that in the pocket now in Indianapolis, and I'm super happy for him. I always root for guys like that, but I'll just see a guy move around and be able to make plays on his own. It's really nice, and I think it brings fans to the stadium and want to watch Giants football again. And they're competitive every week. There's no embarrassing games anymore. And I'm always looking forward to Sundays when I lose now.
Well, yeah, that's a great way to look at it, because there is some excitement. Cam Scataboo as well. You know, these guys, they're just bringing that kind of energy that the fan base has been dying for. I'm interested to see when I go home today what Coach Brian Daboll had to say, you know, about the game. I'm sure he's super frustrated afterwards. But as you said, one to build on, tough loss, but they're going to bounce back. AJ, always great to have you on. Looking forward to some more positives coming out of the New York Giants. And we'll talk to you soon, buddy.
All right. Thank you so much, guys. Have a great rest of your show.
You as well. Thanks so much. A.J. Roebner, our Giants reporter. All right, we're going to take a short break, and then we'll come back on the second half of WGBB Sports Talk New York.
Listening to Sports Talk New York. Tune in every Sunday night at 8 p.m. on Long Island's WGBB. Broadcasting on 95.9 FM and 1240 AM. Or listen live online at WGBBRadio.com. Stay connected to Sports Talk New York on WGBB by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at WGBB Sports Talk. You're listening to Sports Talk New York on Long Island's WGBB. And now, back to the show.
And welcome back to the second half hour on Long Island's WGBB Sports Talk New York. Once again, I'm your host, Mike Wadone, along with Chris Caputo, Cappy. And we had an interesting first half hour there. Hit on a couple of different topics, Mets. Giant collapse there at the end. Although, you know, I love having AJ on, Cappy, because he really does. He brings the positive, and you know, God bless him.
He's in the stadium.
Yeah,
you know,
he's there all the time.
Home games, and you know, that's a tough time. But if they would have won that game today, there would have been a big high.
Yeah.
And now by losing, it just kind of deflates that situation.
Yeah, moral victories, I know, are for. I think that's for, you know, junior high and JV football, but. We'll take it. We'll do what we can and go from there. But our next guest, I'd like you to bring him in because I know you have a very good perspective on this story and looking forward to speaking with him.
Okay, so right now we're going to welcome in from Malvern, New York, a Chaminade graduate, the punter for the Maine Black Bears. It's Anthony Pecorella. Thanks for joining us, Anthony.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
All right, so it's Chris and Mike here. So, Anthony, you started out as a football player at Chaminade. What positions did you play there?
When I was at Chaminade, I was a quarterback, believe it or not, and a kicker and a punter.
And your dad played at Hofstra at some point, so was football kind of in the family blood?
Yeah, football's always been something. In fact, you know, we have a picture on our wall in our house, and our motto is faith, family, football. And if we could add one more, it'd be food, because we have a vowel at the end of our names.
Oh,
but,
yes.
Yeah, football. Football is something that's always been kind of embedded in us. My dad played at Hofstra, and then after he played semi-professional for the Brooklyn Mariners and the Marlboro Shamrocks. So growing up as a little 5-6-year-old kid, you grew up on the sideline watching your dad play. So oftentimes people ask, oh, who's your favorite football player? And I always say my dad, because just he exemplified what it meant to be a man on and off the field. And he's the one that kind of shared his love of the game with me, and it's why I hold it near and dear to my heart.
Nice. So eventually you get recruited, and, you know, you can talk a little bit about the recruitment process and how you wound up at Maryland.
So a lot of people think that recruiting is just this walk in the park, rose petals everywhere, like it's just easy. But unless you're kind of in that top 1%, it's not always, I guess, all sunshine and rainbows. So for a while, a lot of schools would reach out, but everything was kind of in limbo. I spoke a lot with Maryland, Penn State, Syracuse, Wake Forest, Duke. And what was happening was a lot of these schools, they'd tell you, oh, well, you're one of our top two guys. And I was like, okay, great. But I was 16, 17, and these schools are telling you that, and you just kind of get a little gullible to it. But Maryland was always one that kind of stuck out from the rest because they were always up front of where they were at. And, in fact, it was the staff before the Michael Loxley staff, the DJ Durkin staff, that first recruited me. And the problem was I probably would have committed to Maryland way earlier than I did. But unfortunately, that whole staff had gotten fired. And so a lot of back of my recruitment is kind of is in limbo. And when Mike Loxley got hired, they brought a man in named John Papuchis as a special teams coordinator. I'll never forget. So going to Chaminade, as anyone knows from Long Island, all boys Catholic high school, you put your phone in your locker, you don't see it at the end of the day. And I remember opening my phone at the end of the school day, and I had a text from the director of player personnel at the time, Dave Mangarini, and from John Papuchis, both had called me. So I had missed phone calls, missed texts. I'm thinking, oh, there goes my shot at Maryland. But lo and behold, as we all know the story goes, it was actually Super Bowl Sunday 2019, a day I'll never forget, that I officially committed to the University of Maryland.
So, Anthony, this is Mike Winnow. Welcome to the program once again. Great to have you on. While you were looking at Maryland and looking at the other schools, was it always that you were going to be a punter, or were there any other positions that you had thought about playing, or was it even discussed with you, or was it kicking straight on?
Hey, Mike, thanks to get on the call with you. So with me, it was kind of an interesting process because I'd always been a quarterback my whole life, and I'm a football junkie. So kickers and punters don't exactly always go hand-in-hand with being football junkies.
Sure.
So with my talent as a quarterback, I probably would have played at the Division III, Division II level, whereas my kicking and punting gave me the opportunity that every kid that plays football kind of wants that opportunity to play in front of hundreds of thousands of people. But in reality, I always kind of thought of myself more as a kicker than a punter. In fact, because I had made a 52-yard field goal my junior year of high school. I was an all-metro guy as a kicker and a punter, but it was more so I knew what I was doing when I was kicking, but when it came to punting, it was more so I just had a strong leg and I knew I had an idea of what to do. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't until my junior year I'd gone to a camp at Penn State, and they told me based on my size that I would be, I guess from an eye test point of view, I'd be more of a punter than a kicker. And that's when I started working with a punting coach named Charlie Titus. His tagline is New Jersey Punting Coach. And we kind of had to like break it down to the basics of it. Because my whole thought process with punt was one, to kick it as hard as you can. And now I know, obviously, how much more technique and fundamentals go into that. So as far as like, did I always think I'd be a punter? No. Selfishly, I always thought I'd be a quarterback, but I like to call myself a fourth down quarterback, so I guess it's the closest thing I can get to being that quarterback.
So, Anthony, I remember watching your games on TV, and you're at Maryland, and you got some high points where you're, you know, averaging 49 yards a punt in a game, or kicking something 56 yards, and, you know, pinning people inside the 20 was always your forte. What were the highs and the lows? Because I know it was also you and a lefty punter, and it was kind of like, depending on which way the field was tilted, was who was going to be the punter that time. Can you talk a little bit about that experience?
Of course. Yeah, it's kind of a unique experience, and it's funny. So Colton Spangler is the other punter that you were talking about, Chris, and we still to this day have a great, great relationship. We kind of brought the best out of each other in practice and in games because you never were comfortable because we had this unique, to all the listeners out there don't really understand the whole what Chris is talking about. So we showed up at the University of Maryland the same day, I was a righty, he was a lefty. And the scheme that we ran was kind of like a mix of, you see, like the Australian style where they roll out, but also with traditional, because we're obviously not Australians. So you couldn't really roll left as a righty, and you couldn't roll right as a lefty. You couldn't roll right as a lefty, and you couldn't roll left as a righty. So they kind of came up with this happy median, especially because we were both true freshmen, that they thought it would kind of take the load off of us. And the plan was to, one of us just at one point would outright win the job. So we played our freshman year, our sophomore year, and our junior year, and it was an even split, but whether it was 51-49 or 52-48, it was pretty close to being right down the line. But I enjoyed it a lot because I got the opportunity to play in the Big Ten as a true freshman, and not a lot of people are blessed enough to say that. So if that meant me splitting the job at that time, it didn't really bother me, I guess, as a lot of other people made it out to be. But obviously then after four different special teams coordinators during my 4 years at Maryland, ultimately got to my senior year, and we had played, I think it was, we had been through 8 games or 9 games at that point, and I only had appeared in 4 games. So you kind of have to, as much as you're for the team, you also have to think about yourself a little bit. And after a lot of tough conversations with my family, with my coaches, I ultimately decided that I was going to redshirt the rest of my senior year, which is kind of funny. I kind of did it everything backwards.
Right.
But it ended up paying dividends for me because had I not have done that then, I wouldn't have this year. And we'll kind of get into my whole story of everything that happened in between that. But I, regardless of the highs or lows that I experienced at Maryland, I was just truly blessed to wear the uniform, to represent the university. Still really close with a lot of people who are still there, who have graduated, gone to play on in the NFL or Canada. And it's an experience that I got to share with my family that I wouldn't change a single thing about.
So we're talking to Anthony Pecorella, and we're going to get into some of the highs and lows that you've gone through. So you decide to commit to another year at Stony Brook, and then things kind of change for you. Can you talk a little bit about some of the changes for you?
So I remember when I committed to Stony Brook University, and it was at the time it was Coach Chuck Peori, and Chuck and I understood each other very well, both being Italian, both being very set in our ways, and he kind of laid out and said, "This is what I need from you. Can you come here and do this for me?" And of course, I said, "Of course, Coach. Would love to come home and represent Stony Brook." I grew up a Hofstra fan, selfishly, because that's where my dad went. But to get the chance to represent Long Island in anything I do is something I really enjoy. So I transferred from the University of Maryland to Stony Brook. I got on campus in June of 2023. Everything was going great. We were working out. But I had this tonsil in the back of my throat that first showed up the last week before my graduation at the University of Maryland. And I'm a 22-year-old kid, healthy. So I didn't really let it bother me. It didn't bother me to swallow or breathe. So it didn't inhibit anything with football, so I kind of just kind of put it on the back burner. But I'd moved home, and so I'm around my family more than I ever was the last 4 years I was at Maryland. And so I was going for my annual physical, and my mom had told me, "Hey, when you see the doctor, make sure he takes a look at that." And right. Obviously, I told my mom, yeah, mom, whatever. And I go to the doctor's office, and I saw a doctor who wasn't my usual primary care doctor. And my whole thought process was, I just want to get the boxes checked, make sure I'm okay, and then go play football. And the doctor looked at my tonsil, and he said, "Does it bother you?" And I said, "No, not at all." He goes, "Okay, well, don't worry about it." So that's all the answer I wanted to hear. So I went home and told my mom, who I love dearly. I know she's listening to this right now, and she's laughing. And I looked at her. I said, "Mom, the doc said no problem." And Chris and Mike, when I tell you that she looked at me like I was the idiot I was standing before her, she said, "There's no way. We need to go back and see your primary care doctor." And we right. did 2 weeks later. And she took one look at it, flipped out, sent me for a testing of everything under the sun, sent me to a specialist, ear, nose, and throat specialist, and just
was a complete 180 from the first doctor that saw it. And I go to the specialist, and the specialist looked at it and said, I don't know what that is. Come back in a month, and we'll see if it goes away. And within that month, I started chemotherapy, believe it or not. And I know that's kind of a, like, everybody, it's always, when I always tell that story, it's always like a pin drop moment.
Sure.
And I only found out that I had cancer, for that matter, was because I went to another specialist, and he took one look at it, and he said, that's got to come out. So this was, at this point, this is late July, so I'm only on Storybrooke campus for 1 month at this point. And I went to see Coach Peori, and I said, I'm going to miss the first 2 days of camp getting this tonsil removed, but I'll be all good to go, no problem. He said, yeah, do what you got to do. So July 20th, 2023, I got the tonsil removed, and the doctor told my family and I that when the results come in, regardless if they're good or bad, I'm going to call and tell you to come in, because he didn't believe in giving results over the phone, which I, to this day, truly appreciate, because had I got that news over the phone, my emotions would have been running even more than they already were. And so on July 26th, the doctor called and said, the results are in, come see me. And my mom and I always went to appointments together, so that was nothing out of the ordinary. But my dad, who works in Manhattan, had asked, oh, do you want me to come with you to this appointment? And I was like, still kind of on this, like, cockiness, like, oh, it's nothing. Like, Dad, go to work. It's not a big deal. No problem. I probably just had a bad case of mono or something. And he respected what I said, and he went to work. And we went to the doctor's office. And it's over 2 years ago, and I like, still remember it vividly. We walked into the office, and we didn't go to a patient room. We went right to the doctor's personal office. And we sat down, and I was on the side of his desk, and my mom was sitting in front. And he cut right to the chase, and he said, I have good news and I have bad news. And so I asked for the bad news first, and he said, you have lymphoma. And so it kind of, unless you're, I guess, have a family member or you've experienced yourself, you don't exactly just say lymphoma, bang, cancer is the first thing that comes to your head, at least for me. So it kind of took me a good 30 seconds to process that I have cancer, like, oh, my God. And I said, what could possibly be the good news? And he said, well, if you were to go to a grocery store and pick out a cancer that you can beat, this is the one, because you're young and you're healthy and you're going to be fine. And so obviously I was a wise guy, and I said, oh, thank you, Jesus, Mom, we're going to be okay. I have cancer, but hey, it's going to be okay. And this silence, almost a deafening silence, fell over the room. Someone has to speak first, because you're trying to figure out, do I make a joke to make it lighter? Do I keep it a serious tone? And I'm always the light in the mood type. And so I asked the doctor if I could go to practice that Tuesday, because I told my coach I'd be back on Tuesday. And he looked at me like I had 18 heads and said, I'm not going to tell you no. I never tell a patient they can't do something. He said, but you should go home and sit with your family and kind of let it sink in of what you have in front of you. And that's when it really first hit, was when I got in the car with my mom. We both just broke down. Because not that it broke down because of the diagnosis, but more just you feel kind of helpless. And because it's something out of your control. It's not like I can contract a virus of some sort. It's just a freak thing. And so the first person we called was my father, who happened to just be walking out of St. Patrick's Cathedral because he was saying a prayer. God forbid it was the worst of it, and as we know, it was. And he was kind of that first, I guess, tone of, it's going to be okay. And similarly to what the doctor had told us on our way out, that this is just going to be a bump in the road, and that kind of was the mindset we adopted attacking this whole thing, was that it's just going to be a bump in the road. But so told my dad, went home. And as Chris knows, I have a twin sister, and she had been working from home that day. And so I walked in, I yelled upstairs, said, Leslie, can you come downstairs? No, I'm busy. Leslie, I got something I really want to tell you. Can you please come down? No, I'm busy. And as anyone knows who has a sister, once they get a tooth, like, now they're pissed. So now my mom comes in, and says, get your butt down here right now. It's like, this is important. So she comes down and huffing and puffing. And now I know that it's going to break her even more because of how she's acting in that moment. And so I sat her down. I told her. And I, to this day, it was the hardest person I had to tell because that's my other half.
Sure.
And it's always just been me and her through everything. And to share that with her was just gut-wrenching. So telling everyone after that wasn't difficult, and I made sure that I was always the person that told friends and family because I wanted them to hear from me and not kind of hear my mom say it and suspect, oh, what's his mindset about this? Is he down on himself? Is he really that sick? Like I always tell a story, a good friend of mine, Frank, I kind of took the news really hard, as anyone would with their best friend gets diagnosed with cancer. And all he wanted to do was just to see me, to know that I wasn't, I guess, ill. And he walked in, I'm there for you, he walked in the house, and he saw me. And at this point, I hadn't started chemo, and I'd just been diagnosed 2 days before. He's like, oh, you look fine. I go, it doesn't work that way. It doesn't just overnight all of a sudden just make you bald and sick. But that's just kind of like my whole mindset. Now, we can get into more of the story, but the story goes on forever. But just from the sense of like that period from when I first got the stone work, I was there a month, and then I had to walk into the coach's office and tell him I was just diagnosed with lymphoma and I'm not playing this year.
Mike, this comes from one of their assistant coaches who passed away that summer, too, and Coach Collins.
Yeah, Collins. What a man he was.
You know, throwing darts all over the place there.
Unbelievable.
So, Anthony, a couple of months of like 5 to 6 days at a time going for chemo, what was the toughest part of the treatment?
The toughest part, probably there's a lot of it is out of your control.
Right.
I mean, you can control your diet, you can control your mindset, which my parents made sure I did. And I always tell people who were listening to this and who go through cancer, whether it's themselves or their family, you got to give everybody a job because everyone wants to help out in some way, shape, or form. And so for my dad, it was more keeping my mind on, all right, what's next? We got to get ready for next season. You got to keep your weight up. He would make sure I'd get up and go for a walk around the hospital floor every day. And that was his job. My mom was more on just my overall well-being as far as how's my mind? Are you feeling a little depressed? Are you feeling down about yourself? Her job was more keeping me upbeat. And my sister, she gave me about one day in sympathy because her whole thing was, let's keep it real. Like, let's kind of just pretend as if everything is normal. And that was their jobs. But the hardest part is just that a lot of it is out of your control. And like, especially like the first round, I remember how nervous I was. I'd never spent a night in a hospital to that point. So on top of doing chemo, which as anyone knows is, you wouldn't wish on your worst enemy because it's feel nauseous, you lose your hair, you get mind numbing headaches. And it's supposed to be making you better. So it's kind of like a catch-22 where you almost have to get sicker to get better. But the hardest part was definitely just a lot of it is out of your control. But that's why it's so important to surround yourself with people that kind of pick you up on those days. And I was blessed to be on the floor that I was in the hospital at Weill Cornell Medical Center because the nurses on that floor were angels on earth. And I will take that to my grave that without them, I wouldn't be here. And then Dr. Lisa Roth and her team with Mindy Jaffe they provided care that was second to none. And that not only were they, as far as from a medical standpoint, but just from a compassionate standpoint, understanding that while to them this is Tuesday, to us this is a life-altering event that we'll forever remember for the rest of our lives. But I owe it all to them.
Anthony, I imagine going through everything you did, you know, and thankfully, obviously, you've come out in a great way. But I'm sure at some point you must have, you know, gotten into maybe some dark places where you think about your future, about what it's going to be like or even if you're going to have a future.
And you hit the nail on the head there. And what's funny is I always in your darkest times you learn the most about yourself, especially those nights in the hospital, because my mom and dad would always tell, do you want us to stay? And I said, no, I'd rather you get away go home, take a shower, have a nice meal. Just like, allow yourself to separate from this a little bit, because I have to be here. I understand that they would do anything for me, but I just wanted them to kind of have a moment away, because as much as it was beating me up, I always say it was harder on them, because both of them would have taken that cancer from me and gone through the chemo themselves. But as far as from a dark point, I wouldn't say I ever got too down, because I always knew that some good was going to come out of this, because I always think everything happens for a reason. And in fact, there was this little girl on the floor who she was going through chemo herself, and her mantra was just keep swimming. And I remember hearing it for the first time, thinking like, oh, how cute is that? Like, oh, Finding Nemo.
Yeah.
But I've kind of adopted it as my own, like my own model today and every day and everything I do. Whether you're in the deepest of waters or the shallowest of waters, and you just got to keep swimming. And at some point, you're going to get to that light at the end of the dark tunnel. Because everyone in life, as we all know, has their own stuff that they go through. With me, it happened to just be a life-altering disease. I hope some people are fortunate enough to not go through that, but everyone goes through their own thing. But that's kind of why I adopted the whole just keep swimming mantra, because in reality, is whether it's losing a football game or getting diagnosed with cancer, if you just tell yourself, like, just keep swimming, eventually you're going to find some good in it.
Positive mindset. Anthony, this is year 7 for you now in college, correct?
Yes, sir.
It's a lot of fun.
Stay in there as long as you can.
That's what everyone keeps telling me.
I'm sure it's great to see the success. You're back on the field. How was that feeling when you finally got back on the field for Maine this year?
So for 2 years, I played the moment over my head so many times, and it's funny. The first time I stepped on the field this year, we were playing Liberty, and I remember being so nervous for my first punt. And then the opening quarter, we didn't punt at all. And I'm thinking, like, all right, okay. And then the second quarter, we still hadn't punted, but we scored a touchdown. And I'm the holder on the field, and I'm thinking, wow, I waited 1,022 days to hold for a field goal. How cool is this? And I remember, like, it almost, like, I wasn't emotional, because I'm thinking, like, all right, this is, like, I was just kind of thinking like it was practice.
Yeah.
But when I went out for the first punt, the punt itself doesn't even matter. I think it was a 43-yard fair catch, but the punt itself didn't matter. It's just the fact that I was standing there and I got to play. I remember coming to the sun, I literally just broke down on my knees and I just said, thank you. With all the ups and downs the last 2 years has brought, just to kind of have that moment, and my family will have that moment for the rest of our lives.
Well, Anthony, we appreciate you coming on and telling your story. We hope you enjoy the rest of your last year as an athlete in college. And thank you for giving us some time
thank
tonight.
Thank you so much, Anthony.
Thank you guys for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Amazing story. Very inspirational. And all the best to you.
Great story.
That's a way to end off tonight.
Yeah, positive note.
Really, yes. Thanks to Connor Clark, A.J. Rover, Brian Graves behind the glass, and, of course, Anthony Pecorella. Go get him, buddy. That's
everybody have a great week.
All right, we'll see you in a couple of weeks, guys.
The views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.